You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Chairman by Eric Konigsberg, with photos by Wayne Mazur. The case has gripped certain segments of a nation for whom patrimoine, royal objects, and state-run museums possess a measure of public importance not quite fathomable in the U.S. Versailles is one of France's great institutions, and for some, Payot's crime is a fraud against the national identity, says Harvey Bellet, Le Monde's reporter on the case. The notion of extremely wealthy collectors being taken advantage of is nearly as titillating. In Paris Match, Payot was called the Bernard Madoff of art. William Eisland, a London antiques dealer who, in light of Payot's arrest, has launched a forensic effort to determine the authenticity of several world-class collections, told me that a number of his peers have long had a reputation for selling fakes. But this stuff typically hasn't come to court, because when rich people discover they've been had, they're too embarrassed to come forward. The news from Versailles has sent the multi-billion-dollar market for French antique furniture into a tailspin. The proprietors of Paris's storied Galerie Cramer, one of the houses through which Payot's ring allegedly sold fakes, have received court protection to structure a limited reimbursement plan for former clients, and face indictments and lawsuits from several collectors, including one over a pair of allegedly fraudulent cabinets it sold for more than $6 million. Cramer maintains its innocence in the Versailles-related case and claims to have been Payot's unknowing victim. A number of American collectors who purchased furniture through Payot or Cramer over the years flew expert restorers to their homes from Paris last year to try to determine whether they owned forgeries. The duel between a forger and a sleuthing pursuer should be a simple morality play, but in this case the protagonist personalities complicate the plot. Payot, our villain, remains so convinced of his enduring likability that after the hitch in jail, he celebrated his provisional return to civilian life by reinstalling himself on the benefit party circuit. He posed for photographs in Le Figaro and Paris Match, telling interviewers that he'd had Balzac novels delivered through the prison gates by family members, and lamenting the shortcomings of the correctional system library. The problem is that prison is not made for intellectuals, he told the French edition of GQ. Even before his arrest, Payot had cut a high-profile figure, an enfant terrible, well into middle-aged bachelorhood. He is now 54. With long hair, round spectacles, and an egg-like countenance, he bears some resemblance to a groovy Benjamin Franklin. Payot's 1987 book, The Art of the Chair in 18th Century France, is still widely viewed as the Bible on its subject, and earned him the punning nickname Père Lachaise. Then there's Horman, our hero, whistleblower, upstart, purist, scold. At 41, he remains saddled with a hand-to-mouth existence, working solo from a ground-floor atelier in an elegant apartment building he's constantly declaring himself unable to afford. It's in the 8th arrondissement, in the same neighborhood where he was raised and where Payot and the leading furniture galleries along Rue des Faubourgs Saint-Honoré reside, but a world away if you're measuring by hours spent waiting for the phone to ring. I'm seen as the baddie here, for reasons I don't understand, he says. Even those on Horman's side in the case, defrauded parties, and people with reputations imperiled by Payo's dishonest acts, can sound ungrateful. Nobody trusts Charles, because he's too much, says François-Joseph Graff, a decorator in Paris whose clients are among the world's biggest collectors and who has collaborated with Orman to try to unravel the extent of Payot's deceptions. He's too direct, at such volume. He doesn't know how to speak in a way that's not crude. Orman spends a lot of time thinking about Payot, wondering when he'll run into him, and inquiring through mutual acquaintances about public sightings of him. Bill probably wants to punch me in the face, I'll bet, he says. I put him in jail, but if you meet him, tell him I will always like him. Payot, for his part, is dismissive of Orman. He's very clever, but nobody knew of him before this affair, he says. Still, he concedes, Charles loves armchairs. Next photos. The fake forgery of a chaise made for Madame du Barry, bought by Versailles in 2009. The real, one of the authentic du Barry chaise made by Louis Delanois, circa 1769. The fake forgery of a bergère made for Madame Elizabeth, acquired by Versailles in 2011, and then reupholstered. The real and authentic bergère made by Jean-Baptiste Claude Sinet from Madame Elizabeth's reception room. And in these photos, these chairs look remarkably alike. There are many people for whom the ornately carved and richly upholstered furniture made for the French royal palaces between 1680 and 1790, a span that encompasses the Enlightenment, Rococo, and neoclassical periods, and the reigns of Louis XIV, XV, and XVI, represents a high point of Western culture. The designer Patrick Orcade has called it the period when furniture became art for the first time. Leon Dalva, a prominent New York dealer in French antiques, describes the era's output as the finest expression on earth of natural materials and man-made artistry. In the preface to Payot's book, Karl Lagerfeld, an early mentor and prominent collector, wrote, "With the exception of Watteau, Fragonard, Chardin, and a few others, the language of these craftsmen was almost more universal than the language of French painters of the same period." After the Revolution, however, as graceful lines gave way to the martial taste of Napoleon's empire period, and labor-intensive techniques were lost to the industrial age, the furniture itself dispersed. In 1793, the meticulously documented contents of Versailles went up for sale at an auction that lasted 2 years. The largest quantities were purchased by British aristocrats for their country houses, but much of it also wound up in Italy, Germany, Russia, and the great family collections of the United States, such as the Gettys, now housed in its own museum, and the Reitzmans, which now constitutes a major wing at the Met. For Americans, it was a way of acquiring class and establishing refinement, says Maria Rossi Mosseri, a former director of the Parisian gallery Aveline. It was a stop on the Grand Tour. Families brought their decorators. That market thrived more or less until the end of the 20th century, but contracted recently, hurt by both the financial crisis and the late era vogue for contemporary art, which, the thinking goes, doesn't match with such fussy objects. Next photographs. The fake forgery of a Belvedere chair, a pair of which were sold by Gallery Kramer to a private collector. The real, one of 8 authentic neoclassical side chairs made for Marie Antoinette's Belvedere Pavilion. The fake forgery of a chaise made for Marie Antoinette, sold privately by Sotheby's in Paris in 2011. The real, an authentic chaise made by Georges Jacob for Marie Antoinette's Meridien room. Payet's expertise in furniture and chairs specifically began in earnest when he informed his art history advisor at the Université de Paris of his radical desire to write a master's thesis on the subject. He said he'd never had a student ask to do that, recalls Payot, whose father owned an antiques shop in Burgundy. I chose armchairs because France, during Louis XV, invented the manner for people to be seated in order to have conversation by setting the legs at an angle, moving the seat closer to the ground, and, to accommodate the hoop dress, allowing the armrest to extend from farther behind the legs. Bill saw that chairs are sexy, Lorman tells me. The description of an 18th-century chair is the form of the female body. The belt of a seat rail comes in at the waist. If an upholsterer does his job right, the seat back is voluptuous, and the backrest is sloped and curved like the form of a woman. Woo-woo! He makes an hourglass with his hands. When Payot began working for Didier Aron's gallery, he says, I quickly became his spiritual heir. Aron had 2 sons to inherit his business, but one moved to New York to run an outpost of the dealership, and the other was mostly interested in old master paintings. I was extremely rare among antiquaires in that I had an art history background, Payot says. While dealers could authenticate chairs, few could speak fluently about the pedigrees and provenances of the item. That was my power, he says. I began finding pieces for all the big collectors, François Pinault, Henri Crivy, Madame Reitzman. I went to their houses. I gave them advice. In no time, Payot's expert eye was sought by the competition and by public collections, putting him on both sides of an already fuzzy line between church and state. The auction houses would quote my book in their catalogs. If a piece was for sale and anyone at a museum wanted my opinion, it was natural for them to ask me. I know every curator. Payot liked the social aspect of his job and tended toward conspicuous consumption that appeared to be beyond the means of even somebody at the top of the field. I'm always outside with my girlfriends, yes, Payot says, but I earned the money I spend legitimately. Christian Beer, a lawyer who represents the National Syndicate of Antiquarians, is in a civil case against Payot, says, I've seen his receipts, and he spends more on old Bordeaux in a year than I earn in my job. His Porsche 911 Targa has an interior designed by Victor Vasarely. He was never seen wearing anything other than one of the more than 100 custom-made 3-piece drainpipe trouser suits he owned. Horman is Parisian to his bones, a child of privilege for whom furniture represented an errant, if sophisticated, career path. His father was an executive for a pharmaceutical manufacturer and later for a multinational cement company. He and his siblings graduated from Lycée Vignelon, one of France's elite crammer schools. But Horman describes himself as a poor student, and he wound up not at one of France's selective grandes écoles, but at the Sorbonne. It was a great anxiety of mine, what I was going to do with my life, until I took Bill's course in decorative arts. He corresponded to my renegade taste. He was like rap music. Something in me just clicked. Horman struggled to hold down jobs at a series of antiques galleries and auction houses, so he struck out on his own at 25. They said I was too aggressive. A lot of firings or invitations not to return. He likes to call his métier flipping chairs, and he means it in both senses of the word. A lot of epiphanies come after months of detective work at the French National Archives, but a lot of epiphanies come after 10 minutes with the underside of a back rail. The trick is finding originals that have somehow been misattributed as copies, he says. People pay top dollar if you can establish the one-time presence of the Queen's derriere. In 2012, for example, he paid $16,250 at auction to acquire a fauteuil, an armchair with open panels between the arms and the seat. If the space is upholstered, you call it a bergère, then sold it the following year for $788,000. I could tell from the carving that it was the identical twin of the only known piece in a particularly beautiful set of chairs built for Madame de Pompadour, one of Louis XV's favorite mistresses, Horman says. Relying on access to the crumbling, boxed inventories of the original royal furniture orders, he was able to piece together the chair's history. From the assembly hall of Chateau de Crécy to the Duke of Penthievre, to the Castle of Nuit, to eventually a very sweet heart surgeon in Memphis, Tennessee, who possessed no idea what he had on his hands, he says. Neither did Christie's, which was listing it mistakenly as part of a rather humble six-piece salon suite from the 19th century. But that was a rare score. I wish I had another right now because I'm broke, Orman said one evening last year when I visited him at his home office. He'd been waiting for more than 2 months for his share of the payment on a giant sofa he'd managed to flip with loans from the bank and a fellow dealer. He couldn't sit still, partly because he kept stooping to pluck discarded nails from the floor, fearful that one of his 5 young children, whose ages range from 3 to 12, would step on one if they came to say good night, but also because he likes to rotate his seating options to avoid unequally wearing down anything he hopes to sell. He was especially tense because he had 3 modest lots up for auction at Sotheby's that day, and none had appeared to attract much presale interest. Orman has finely wrought Gallic features and a loping bow-legged gait. As a boy, he spent 2 years in Westchester County, outside New York City. And as we watched the auction results on his computer, only his cheapest item sold, netting him about $60, he sounded a bit like an American game show host. "We're here live. Come on, baby. Relax, sweetheart. Chairs sell well." His expertise in the field is widely acknowledged, but he seems unable to refrain from playing the pest. Some colleagues make cross-eyed faces at the mention of his name. Some describe him as a bit of a mystic, a coded way of slighting him for his devout Catholicism. He often, for example, characterizes any stroke of good fortune in the furniture market as a present to me from the Lord. When Horman attended the early viewing of one auction house's spring furniture sale in Paris, he moved swiftly through the exhibition rooms, turning over any chairs to look at the bare wood of the seat rails. It took him less than an hour to conduct a personal appraisal of every chair and sofa, partly because most of his fellow collectors and dealers appeared to be avoiding him, and declare his certainty that at least 2 lots, classified as 18th century, a cream velvet fauteuil and a pair of dining chairs, were fakes. with the first. His grievance had to do with the shapes of the wormholes on the bottom of the seat. With the other, the problem was the calligraphy on the ostensible chairmaker's label. He'd seen it on a fake elsewhere recently. This guy was doing forgeries 40 years ago, and suddenly they're back on the market. He approached a director of the auction house, shared his findings, and was politely but firmly escorted out after a 20-minute exchange of whispers. In the days that followed, the house phoned him several times to argue, then to say that some ambiguity was possible, and finally, when Horman refused to accept this as an option, to inform him that it was removing one of the lots from the sale but keeping the other. They said it would be hard to say no to the seller, Horman said after the last call, sighing. Most of them would rather I disappear. A few months after Horman sounded his first alerts to Versailles about the folding benches, he became suspicious of another acquisition the museum had made back in 2009. It involved two Afour chaises, which Versailles bought for some $1.9 million from the Gallery Kramer. The chaises, part of a set of 12 identical armless chairs, were believed to have been built in 1769 by the furniture maker Louis Delanois for the private suite at Versailles of Madame du Barry, the last mistress of Louis XV, a former Parisian prostitute whom he once allowed to sit on his fauteuil during a meeting of his council cabinet. Her quarters were directly above his bedroom. They're important because of the simple but beautiful design, which is considered among the best examples of the transition between the Louis XV and Louis XVI styles, says Alistair Clark, who, as a former head of Christie's European Furniture Division, once examined and sold several other pieces in the set to Versailles. The chairs have fluted legs and an oval or medallion backrest. Next photograph, the admitted forger Bruno Desnoyers at work in his studio. The lot Versailles purchased comprised two distinct pairs, one of which had been regilded and reupholstered, commonplace refurbishments that on their own do nothing to diminish a piece's worth. But over lunch one day, a client of Horman's told him he'd seen the restored pair before, under a different description. Several years earlier, the collector said, Payot had invited him to his home, and revealing them to him dramatically from beneath a sheet, offered to sell the chairs privately. The client said Payot had told him the chaises were royal, and asked a price of about $250,000. But when I saw later that Versailles purchased them for three times that, I thought, I'm so stupid, the client told me. The man said he didn't imagine they were fakes, because who would copy something so famous? The French police have since determined that one of the two pairs acquired by Versailles in 2009 had made its way to Kramer via an antiquarian named Guillaume Dillet, who happened to be Payot's close friend and claimed somewhat mysteriously to be selling them on behalf of a wealthy French family he would not name. Orman thought it was unlikely that four of the famous Du Barry chairs would turn up on the market at the same time. He knew from Delanois' journal entries regarding the original transaction that a set of 12 identical chaises plus a taller chair for the king himself had been delivered to Louis XV. The museum was already in possession of six chairs, the last of which it had purchased at auction in Brussels in 2011, and a collector in Switzerland had bought two in 2001 from the estate of André Meyer, the senior Lazare Frères partner in New York. Horman thought he had seen a single chair from the set at the home of a French collector, So if you added the four chairs Versailles acquired in 2009, that gets us up to at least 13. Too much, Horman concluded. Whoever was behind the sale to Versailles had done the math wrong by making a pair instead of just one. If they were indeed copies, he reasoned, the forgers probably hadn't yet known of the existence of the chair that would later come on the market in Brussels. Orman studied photos of Versailles' acquisition and swore he could see the hand of Bruno Dunois, an ebeniste or woodworker who ran his own studio in the Bastille district. I had visited him not long before, and I knew he was Payot's favorite, Orman says. Payot describes his relationship with Dunois as strictly professional. I bouvoyer with him, he says. Dunois likes to boast to visitors of his workroom that on occasion he employed his skill as a copyist to anonymously put convincing reproductions on the market, and at a higher rate than his standard fee of 60 to 70 euros an hour. According to one client, he kept a large pile of auction catalogs with post-it notes behind his desk, and when pressed, would open them to reveal copies he had made that had sold for prices comparable to original works. It was like his trophy case, his CV, the client recalls. He wanted his customers to know he was good enough to trick the eye. Orman was on to Payot. I started asking around, he says. A lot of people had stories of pieces that didn't feel right. Over the next year, he discovered three more forged lots that had duped Versailles. There was a confection of a giltwood bergère that Versailles had bought, consigned again by Payot's friend for more than $250,000 in 2011. It had been passed off as the property of Madame Elizabeth, a sister of Louis XVI's. The label was torn unconvincingly, sort of shaggy, Orman says, where it should have disintegrated and detached from the humidity. Also, there were no tan lines underneath the missing portions. Wood that was truly from the 18th century, in other words, would have discolored more, and when I magnified the places where two pieces of wood meet perpendicular, the junctions looked perfect, not a millimeter between them. But the wood would have retracted over 200 years. There's supposed to be a measure of air. Then came a $500,000 chair, which Versailles had bought at Sotheby's in 2011. It was ostensibly from Marie Antoinette's Meridian room, the work of Georges Jacob, perhaps the preeminent royal chairmaker of the 18th century. But according to Horman, it had many of the same flaws as the bergère. Finally, there were two armless chairs, again Marie Antoinette's, and this time from Belvedere Pavilion. Versailles had been offered them in 2013, but passed, because the asking price of 4 million euros, again, via Kramer by way of DA, was too steep. Still, palace curators saw fit to have them classified as national treasures, which meant they could never leave France. The prestige of this designation went a long way, and in 2015, the designer François-Joseph Graff bought them for about half the asking price for his client, a member of the Qatari royal family, the Altanis. In each instance, Orman wrote up detailed accounts of his misgivings and emailed them to the curators and directors of Versailles. But for 3 years, his concerns were essentially ignored. I beg you to come together, to act wisely, he wrote in one to the chief curator. As far as I am concerned, I trust in the providence of God. In another, to the museum's director, it is you who heads Versailles or not. It is you who has the power to act on what is happening in your walls or not. It was not until September 2015 that Horman received a phone call from a detective in the OCBC, a division of the French National Police set up to fight cultural trafficking. "We need your help," the detective said. It turned out that an investigation had been in the works for more than a year. First, an automatic notice made the French authorities aware of several conspicuous all-cash purchases by a chauffeur in Paris. A $726,000 house in the Parisian suburbs, 5 apartments in Portugal, 2 Regency vases he then flipped for $288,000. When questioned, the driver, who worked for an art dealer, admitted that his transactions had been made on behalf of his friend, the woodworker Bruno Dunois. So the police searched a safe in Dunois' home and found some $274,000 in cash, then discovered he had more money in a Swiss bank. Dunois told them the account belonged to Payot, and under further questioning, confessed to their elaborate forgery scheme. Payot was arrested on June 8, 2016. After the news broke, Gérard Mabi, the chief curator at Versailles, when the forged pieces had been acquired, told the newspaper La Tribune de l'Art, "I had no reason not to trust Payot, but instead had been suspicious that Orman was wanting to settle accounts with Bill Payot." Laurent Salomé, the museum's director who took over after the scandal, told me that many of the pieces, all of which, as evidence in the case, remain locked in a room at Versailles, to which he possesses the only key, had been offered with elaborate false provenances. "We could have done more, but it wouldn't have been easy," he said. He added that the museum is planning to reorganize the procedures for acquisition and verification. There was a long-standing porousness between dealers and institutions like Versailles and France's art world that abetted the fraud ring. Salomé was at pains to explain that Bruno Dunois, who in 2014 had been commissioned by Versailles to carve a complete replica of Louis XVI's bed based on archival descriptions, the original has never been found, was quietly permitted to return to the palace to finish the work. Even after he served a 4-month jail term for defrauding the museum, he stressed that Versailles had since canceled another contract with Dunois to make a copy of Louis XV's throne. Salomé shook his head. "The decision to stop contact with him was not an easy one," he said, of his predecessor's delayed actions. "There is such respect for the artistry of this man." "The police had read my book. They were very knowledgeable about chairs," Payot tells me. "They woke me up at 8 in the morning. I proposed coffee, but they just wanted a glass of water." Not until that afternoon, when 2 detectives took him to OCBC headquarters, did they ask Payot about the forgery scheme. "I was a little bit surprised. I thought they wanted me for tax fraud. But they knew my entire life. You ate in this restaurant on Thursday, and you went to the south of France that weekend. They had been tapping his phone for more than a year. It was very impressive," he says. Payot and I are in his apartment on Avenue Marceau, near the Arc de Triomphe. A cabinet of curiosities, he calls it. An apartment of the night. The place has trompe-l'oeil friezes resembling green marble, a fireplace mantle modeled on a giant monster's head, stained glass windows, silver leaf paneling, a table in the shape of a crouching dominatrix body, and a Basquiat. His inspiration, he says, was Joris Karl Heisman's novel A Rebours. It concerns a man who took the decision to stay in his flat and have a different ambiance in his home than any place else could offer him, he explains. He said it wasn't necessary to talk to the outside world. Some people who have spoken to Paya about the fraud marvel at his belief that it amounted to an achievement, even as he admitted wrongdoing. He is like Balzac's Rastignac. He thinks he must prove he is the best in all of Paris, says Dominique Chevalier, former president of the National Syndicate of Antiquarians. The judge who interrogated him recorded that he was almost smiling during his testimony. But no matter how outraged the affected parties may be, Paya still has plenty of admirers, not merely for his accomplishments, but for the very fraud he managed to pull off. His knowledge, his nerve, and most of all, the brilliant handiwork of his forgery team, it's as if the genius that gave birth to Versailles and that first made art from furniture is alive in Paya's crime. To some, the very level of difficulty of the forgeries, their consummate craft, mitigates them or even exonerates him. It's why he did what he did, because his knowledge is unique, says Daniel Alcouf, the former head of the Louvre's decorative arts department, who remains a close friend. Paya permits himself a degree of pleasure in what he did. When I brought up the case with him, he said he was under orders from both his lawyer and the police not to discuss it, but he couldn't resist. It began as something very philosophical, he said. That was in 2007, when he, Thénard, and Joël Louanard, a gilder who has also been arrested, created the pair of false Delanois chairs. The sale to Versailles went smoothly. The first time, it was a stupid joke. Gotcha. Nobody sees. The experts don't see. The curators don't see. The dealer doesn't see. When he described for the judge how he and the craftsman hatched their plan, he said the very idea was exhilarating, to humiliate the denizens of his world. We found it amusant, Bruno and Louanard, all of us, he told me. I regret it, of course, because my life is different now. I recognize what I have done. I ought to have stopped after the first, or never. He laughed softly. It's not my mentality to sell 10 fakes. You can make 4, 5, 6 fakes, but after that, it's industriel. Paya couldn't have done it merely for the money. He may well turn out, as the investigation continues, to have profited from the sales beyond what his acknowledged participation paid. His take from the fencing of the $2 million Belvedere chairs, for example, was about $250,000, according to the investigation. Though it's easy to speculate that he got a much larger kickback from the final sale. He insisted he didn't. All the money went to the people who sold it at the end. And framing it as an intellectual game, as one of his friends, Catherine Farage, calls it, was also a way of minimizing the crime. With me, he kept using the odd construction that he'd participated in the sales of the fakes. Still, he had been wealthy beforehand, with a reputation he'd spent decades earning. He threw all of that out the window. Even though he wasn't the artist who'd made the fakes with his hands, he was taken with knowing that nothing, not the idea, and not the theatrical execution, could have happened without him. He said that he'd confessed to the judge of having forged 8 chairs. In addition to the 4 sold to Versailles, there were the 2 bought by the Qatari Royal, and a pair of Jacob Fatois that a prominent collector had wanted to purchase for more than $700,000 and donate to Versailles, but which, following a last-minute alert by Orman, The museum declined in 2013. Still, Paya wouldn't cede much ground to Orman. He disputed Orman's findings on the Ploya. "The Ploya are good," Paya said. "These are being examined at Versailles now." "I ran through the rest of the alleged fakes," Orman suspects him of selling, including a second copy of the Jacob Meridien chair, sold to a scion of the Hermes family for $600,000. Six other fake Ployens, two of them credulously exhibited at Versailles in 2015, and a sofa with a false Marie Antoinette brand, sold to a collector in 2012 for about $550,000. Paya claimed they were all legit. "These are problems of Orman's," he said. He rose from his chair, 18th-century German, in green strié velvet, and offered to make coffee. "After I went to jail, everybody says perhaps there is a problem with color, or réglisse, licorice. But at the time, nobody noticed. For me, it's a little bit easy to say that now. I did it because I thought it was very difficult to see if it's good or not. If it was a bad fake, I wouldn't have participated, wouldn't have done it," he said. "But here is what is most interesting. A perfect fake doesn't exist."
Thank you.
brutal landscapes. For years, men had been disappearing without a trace from Toronto's gay village. By the time authorities arrested a 66-year-old landscaper for the murders, the truest horror might have been how easily he had operated among them. By Xander Sherman. Illustrations by Tomer Hanuka. Opening illustration. Homicide is so rare in Canada that Kathy Gruspier, a 56-year-old single mom, is the country's only full-time forensic anthropologist. And she is shown at work here. In January, more than a dozen fiberglass garden planters arrived at the Ontario Forensics Pathology Service. A glassy 660,000 square foot facility in North Toronto. It was a cold winter, even by Canadian standards, and the 400-pound faux rock containers destined for installation in the city that spring were frozen solid. After letting them thaw for a few days, Dr. Kathy Gruspier began conducting X-rays. When she saw that one of them contained a foreign object, she called Detective Sergeant Hank Itzinga, a hulking homicide cop with the Toronto Police Service. Itzinga's team had helped locate the planters at a private residence on a quiet suburban drive in Leaside and shipped them to Gruspier. "I think there's going to be something in these planters," Itzinga remembers Gruspier saying, "but it could just be a chunk of ice. I don't know." He and his team drove to the lab. By then, the containers had been there for 10 days and were starting to emit a foul odor. In the forensic examination bay, the police watched Gruspier saw the planter she had X-rayed in half. She peeled away the sides to reveal a human head, torsos, and limbs. Through dental and fingerprint analyses, Gruspier's team eventually separated 7 sets of remains. It is hard to overstate how shocking the discovery and its coverage in the press have been in a country where homicide is infrequent and serial killers are almost unheard of. In order of quantity, criminal charges in Canada predominantly relate to theft and other behavior that falls under the legal heading of mischief, destruction of property, for example, or preventing a fellow Canadian from enjoying his or her property. In 2016, there were 611 homicide victims in the entire country. The state of Ohio had 627 that year. The most recent serial murder case involved a 51-year-old nurse who lethally injected several elderly patients with insulin between 2007 and 2016. Homicide is so rare that Gruspier, a 56-year-old single mom, is the country's only full-time forensic anthropologist. But suddenly, newspapers from the New York Post to the Daily Mail were reporting on a series of murders worthy of a Stephen King novel in which immigrants' entry into Toronto's gay subculture proved their undoing. The frothiest tabloid coverage surrounding the case played up its tenuous connection to the horror author's 1975 short story, The Lawnmower Man. As the winter gave way to spring, investigators continued to sort through their grisly yield. By early June, their case had grown to include 8 victims. 6 of them, Skandaraj Navaratnam, Majid Krahan, Abdul Basir Faizi, Sarush Mahmoodi, Salim Essen, and Kirishna Kumar Kanagaratnam, were of Middle Eastern or South Asian descent. Navaratnam was a 40-year-old Sri Lankan Tamil refugee. Kahan was a 58-year-old Afghani man who was married and had a son. Faizi, 42, had been born in Afghanistan but immigrated from Iran and was married and had a family. Mahmoudi, 50, was from Iran and lived with his Sri Lankan wife and stepson, and Asin, 44, was a Turkish citizen. More than half of Toronto's 2.7 million residents identify as a visible minority. Around 15% are South Asian, and 1% come from the Middle East. The city is known for its inclusiveness, but it can still be a challenging place for new Canadian citizens. Nearly all of the men, as well as two other victims, Dean Lisowick, 47, and Andrew Kinsman, 49, had disappeared from the church in Wellesley neighborhood, also known as Toronto's Gay Village, between 2010 and 2017. Though the area's history as an LGBTQ-friendly enclave dates back years, of late, gentrification in the village has driven up the cost of rent, and the area mainly functions now as a meeting place for people who connect online and come into town for drinks. Several of the victims' families have said they didn't know of their loved ones' visits to the village at all, that the men were leading double lives. In November 2012, a month after Kahan's disappearance, the Toronto Police Service convened a task force to find out what had happened. Within a few months, they had uncovered clues to suggest Navaratnam had met with foul play. The leads, which initially pointed to an online cannibalism ring, were dismissed as fantastical and eventually ruled out. But they brought in Singa, a 30-year police veteran, onto the case. Investigators began by interviewing Navaratnam's friends. According to multiple reports, this included a then 60-year-old landscape designer, Bruce MacArthur. Toronto police refused to confirm whether they spoke with MacArthur at that time. Known as Santa for his seasonal employment at a shopping mall, MacArthur was a twinkle-eyed grandfather who liked tropical birds and hated Donald Trump. Born in rural Ontario in 1951, he graduated from Fenelon Falls Secondary School, married his high school sweetheart, and became a salesman, first at Stanfield's and then at McGregor Socks, both Canadian garment manufacturers. The couple had a son and a daughter, now grown. Around 1998, when he was in his late 40s, MacArthur came out and moved to the village. At 5'10" and 221 pounds, Santa was unassuming in both appearance and demeanor. The type who baked muffins, sipped wine, and lavished friends with roses on their birthdays. The kindest person I've ever known is how one of MacArthur's many friends described him, according to police records. The owner and sole proprietor of Artistic Designs, a man in a van landscaping business, he was popular with clients, many of them older, wealthy Torontonians, who appreciated MacArthur's love of succulents, especially exotic varieties with thick, fleshy leaves. Police learned MacArthur had employed Navaratnam as a landscaper. The two had also dated on and off for years. MacArthur was interviewed, then let go, and having failed to find any criminal evidence, Project Houston, as the task force was named in 2013, closed down. Mahmoudi, Lisowick, Essen, Kinsman, and Kanaratnam all vanished over the next 4 years. Next illustration, as Toronto police continued to deny what was obvious to many in the gay village, Hank Edzinga and a small group of detectives quietly launched a new investigation called Project Prism. By summer 2017, pretty much everyone in the village knew there was a serial killer in their midst. All of these men had gone missing, each with a connection to the neighborhood, most from social groups that were marginalized in one way or another. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.